Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds, welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. This week, it's all about the shutdown. To help cut through all of the nonsense on the shutdown, and there is a lot of nonsense out there on the shutdown, we have former House Republican Majority Leader Dick Armey on to give his perspective on the current House Republican leadership. Then we have Bob Cusack, managing editor from The Hill, on to talk about how we go about resolving this mess. If I have time, I'll also go over some of the other news of the week. And as always, we will have our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air next week. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Welcome back. There's so much to talk about regarding this government shutdown. I could talk for hours about it, but I saw a couple of interesting articles and comments in places like Time Magazine about former House Majority Leader Dick Armey that piqued my curiosity, and I decided to try to get him on the show. Dick Armey was House Majority Leader during the government shutdowns in the mid-1990s, and I wanted to get his take on what it's like to be in that position and how he grades the current House Republican leadership on how they're dealing with the situation. My first guest really needs no introduction for those familiar with American politics over the last 30 years. A former congressman from Texas, he served for 18 years in the House, 8 of those as House Majority Leader. He was one of the engineers of what's called the Republican Revolution of the 1990s, in which Republicans swept to control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 40 years. He was one of the authors of The Contract with America. He is a Tea Party favorite and the former head of FreedomWorks. Dick Armey, welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know, I really appreciate you coming on to talk with us. You have been there, exactly where Congress finds itself now, where the Republican leadership finds itself now. You were House Majority Leader during the shutdowns of the 1990s. I read a fascinating article by you in Time Magazine 2 days ago, and I was shocked because you gave the exact opposite view that I thought that you would about the shutdown as a Republican tactic. You don't seem to be in favor of it. Can you explain why that is?
Well, actually, I wasn't in favor of it in 1995. I opposed it even though the conference set on that course quite early in the year. My point is very simple. There have been about 20 shutdowns since the Carter years. And without exception, Republicans have always been blamed and have always been disadvantaged in public opinion during the shutdown, and Democrats have always been advantaged. There's a good reason for that, and I understood that reason, and I argued against it. However, in 95, the shutdown was a strategy that was developed. What people don't recall is we actually had passed the most strategically important part of the discretionary budget, had it signed into law. That's things as the defense budget and military pay and so forth. These really urgent matters were already resolved before we got to the shutdown. So we were actually shut down only the more incidental part, less urgent part of the discretionary budget, and yet that still got hyperbolized into the appearance of a national disaster. Mm. You know, we were focused on fiscal issues, and we were able to work with a competent and willing Bill Clinton, President Clinton, on the fiscal issues, and we had more or less common objectives in the fiscal issues between Republicans and Democrats to get them resolved at a number we could live with. This is an even more egregious case of shutdown in that it wasn't planned for in any way by anybody. It's almost an impulse, as it were, and it, what it did from the Republicans' point of view was it put the Democrats off the hook on a national debate on Obamacare where they, in fact, would be losing ground and moved the Republicans on the hook for a national debate on the shutdown where they would lose ground and gave them no opportunity to make any gain any ground against their objective to defund or delay or in some way mitigate against the ill effects of Obamacare. So basically, the government, the Republicans said, let's start a fight where we are certain we will lose. That doesn't make much sense. As Jeff Flake said, you cannot threaten somebody with a shutdown if they're not afraid of a shutdown. The Democrats actually welcome the shutdown.
Now, see, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, even though, obviously, we disagree about whether Obamacare is a good thing or not, if you have what you think is an advantage, that a president from the other side is advancing an unpopular policy, why would you take the focus off of that, right? But, you know, in saying that, you seem to be disagreeing with the vast majority of your compatriots and Freedom Works and the rest of the Tea Party. Most of them seem to love this shutdown. Have you had conversations with other Tea Party leaders on this? And if so, can you share what some of those conversations have been like?
No, I really haven't, and there seems to be almost a universal feeling, oh, yes, this is a good thing. Well, apparently, from what I heard Grover Norquist give a report, apparently he's in town and he has had conversations to this effect, that they actually thought that they could mount a big grassroots effort and move a lot of Democrat votes and actually win a vote. On the subject. I mean, I cannot understand how could they have suffered such a delusion.
That is delusional.
But apparently they thought that that was possible. What they didn't understand is you had yourself in a clear parliamentary circumstance here. Harry Reid was not going to put the CR with the defunding of Obamacare up for a vote. And the Democrats were not going to vote for it. You're talking to the Democrats to vote against the signature accomplishment of their president, and that was never going to happen. So if anybody was naive enough to believe that somehow or another they could mount over the weekend a grassroots movement that would be big enough to swing that kind of Democrat vote, they must have been operating at the highest degrees of naivete. My own view is they were goaded into it by organizations that saw that as an opportunity to raise money. That's what I think is what's really going on there.
Interesting. Now, in your Time magazine articles, talking about the strategy and the leading up to it and what's happened since, you had some really harsh comments for Speaker John Boehner in that article. Do you think this is a course of action that Speaker Boehner wanted to take? I think you've already sort of opined on that to some extent. Or do you think he was swept along and forced into it by the Tea Party wing of the party?
Well, I didn't mean to have a harsh word because I have a great deal of respect and admiration for John Boehner. My biggest concern for John Boehner in this scenario was I think he was unnecessarily concerned about if I don't go along with the people who want to move in this direction, I could lose my speakership.
Right.
And my own view is he would strengthen his ability, and I said that at the end of the audio. He would strengthen his chance to be a speaker in two regards. If he had avoided this whole shutdown scenario to begin with, or terminates it now, and that is one. People forget the terrible losses we took in the 96 election. I remember sitting up that election night, and it was really a bitter experience to watch so many of my friends go down in flames across the country. The greatest possibility of John Boehner losing his speakership has been born out of the potential losses in the next elections from the public's reaction to this, the blame that the Republicans will receive for this shutdown. Secondly, the numbers, if you just look at the numbers within the conference, the hardcore guys that really wanted to go for this shutdown are not going to be enough votes to cost him his speakership within a leadership race in the House. So I think he was unnecessarily concerned by that. I do think, and as I said, if he rises to the level of his ability and the stature of the office, the leadership position should be, I'm going to save you guys from the folly of your own misbegotten idea.
Well,
and they would have been thanking him for it.
Well, that almost seems a direct criticism of his leadership abilities. But, you know, what I would say to that, from what it seems like to me, looking in from the outside of Congress, is that Boehner seems to have almost a Cassius in his leadership, right? Cassius, the guy from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar with a lean and hungry look. Eric Cantor, who holds your old spot, House Majority Leader, seems ready to figuratively put a dagger in Boehner's back and try to seize the speakership from him if Boehner makes any move that alienates him from the Tea Party caucus. Now, not that I want to make a lot of excuses for him, but that doesn't seem to give Boehner much room to maneuver, right?
Right. I don't know what the relationship is there. I don't know Eric Cantor well. I do know this. Roy Blunt actually appointed Cantor deputy whip. Initially, when Cantor got in leadership, he did not win a leadership election on his own terms. To get there, he was the beneficiary of Roy Blunt's appointment. He then did subsequently turn around and run against Roy Blunt for the whip's position. So certainly Boehner has to look at, I have to recognize that Cantor is perfectly capable of running against and challenging me for speaker. Whether or not there's been discussions between them, threats or intimations to that degree, I do not know about that, but certainly the speaker has to be aware that Cantor has a record that would indicate his willingness, he'd be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, turning to the time when you were House Majority Leader in the 90s, there was a point in the shutdown. There was an interview with former Virginia Representative Tom Davis the other day, and he says that there was a point where he and other Republican congressmen in the 90s during that shutdown were going to you and to Newt Gingrich and pleading with you to end the shutdown, saying things like, we're getting our butts kicked here. Do you think that's happening now? I don't get the sense that that's happening now.
Oh, no, it is happening. As a matter of fact, the key personality in this is Peter King. And you've seen some fairly dynamic of Peter King being the Irish guy that he is, has made his feelings quite clear on this, bless his heart on this. But this is exactly what he's going. Here's the speaker's dilemma, same one we had. The majority of his majority are hard-bitten conservatives, are ready to have the fight, and we'll fight and lose if that's what it takes. But we're going to fight. And the minority of his majority are the moderates are saying, look, you're starting a fight that we can't survive. We don't want to go there. You're putting us in harm's way. You're not putting yourself in harm's way for re-election,
yeah,
but you're putting us in a terrible position. Now, the problem is the minority of the majority is with the majority of the body. So they go to the speaker and they say, look, the majority of this body is shares our point of view, and you're letting the agenda be set by the minority of the body. So you're letting the tail wag the dog. Then when the speaker is responsive to that, he runs into the majority of his majority who say, look, you're listening to a minority of our majority, and you're letting the tail run the dog. I know exactly what John Boehner is there. He's sitting there feeling like he's a two-tailed dog being accused of being wagged by both ends.
So how does he...
And it's a terrible dilemma for him to try to work out.
It is. So how does he extricate himself and his party from this?
My own view is the best model in the whole question of speaker, the speakers I've had the privilege of watching and working with, John Boehner's best model is Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill's position was, and he had the same kind of problem. His position was very simple. Look, I'm the speaker here. I'm the boss. I carry the responsibility, and I have the authority. And I'm going to do what I think is best for the country, best for the Congress, best for my majority. And if you don't like it, you can just, you know, take a long walk on a short pier. And I think that's what I said, rise to the stature of his office and assert himself. I am the speaker here. I know you elected me because you trust my judgment. I exercise my judgment. I'm not going to let you guys run yourselves into an intractable situation from which there doesn't seem to be a way out. And that's what Tip would have done. And that's what Tip did. And I have to tell you, anybody challenged Tip O'Neill took their life in their hands. And Boehner needs to be there.
You know, it seems that we keep coming back to the fact that Boehner has to be a leader. I mean, I know you don't really want to say negative things about him, but he's got to be a leader. That's what we're coming down to.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, quite frankly, I understand how difficult it is. And I think the world is on Boehner. But I did also make the point in my op-ed, Boehner has the ability to be the leader that he must be. And he needs to take confidence of that. And, you know, I made a decision very early in my career that I would never redefine who I was to get or keep a job. There's no job that's so precious that you should allow yourselves to be less than your full potential and ability in order to do the job you're privileged to have. And John just needs to step up to that. I mean, bless his heart, I understand. I know it's not easy, and I know it's a bit scary, but what the heck? I mean, what do you got to lose?
All right.
You know, the fact of the matter is he's speaker, and he will always be speaker. His portrait will always hang in the Capitol for having been speaker. Now, take your moment and take the speakership in your hands and be the speaker. Who would challenge you fear you. Why should you fear them?
Exactly. Old quotes from Admiral Halsey back in World War II. When you're in command, command.
That's exactly right.
All right. We'll have to end it there. All right. Dick Armey, former House Majority Leader, a guy who has been there. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I saw this interview going one way, and it really went in a completely different direction. I'm a little shocked at the direction that it went in. Let me dispense with the obvious first. It's pretty clear to me that there is no love lost between the former and current House Majority Leaders. My impression is that Armey thinks that Eric Cantor is a backstabbing opportunist who turned on his patron and mentor Roy Blunt the moment that he thought he was vulnerable. I think he's probably right about that, too. Boehner has to know that, and he has to know that if he upsets a sizable portion of his caucus, Cantor will be right there trying to take the speakership away from him. Imagine what that would be like, folks. Even within his party, within his party's caucus in Congress, Cantor is a backstabbing and conniving opportunist, without, it seems, a shred of loyalty in his body. Imagine that kind of a person becomes Speaker of the House of Representatives. That kind of a person should never attain a position of leadership in our government. It's partly because of who Cantor is and where he is that we're in this shutdown mess. That's one of the subtexts here. The other thing is, no matter how much Armey likes House Speaker John Boehner and how highly he thinks of him in general, there's no question that he thinks that Boehner has not shown the leadership that he needs to show regarding the shutdown. Charles Pierce of Esquire called John Boehner the castrato Speaker of the House. If you're not familiar with the term castrato, unfortunately, you're going to have to look it up. I'm not sure that I can get away with explaining what it is on the air, but while calling Boehner the castrato Speaker of the House is harsh, if Speaker Boehner thinks the shutdown's bad policy, he needs to step up and bring a clean continuing resolution and debt ceiling bill to the floor of the House and to perdition with the consequences. He's the leader of the House and the House Republican caucus. There's no more juice in the House of Representatives than that. If you can't move the House from that position, you don't belong in the Speaker's position. Of course, you know, the scary thing about that is if Boehner resigns, Cantor gets the gavel. So I guess I'm in the odd position of hoping that Boehner doesn't resign. Now, I didn't agree with everything that Armey said. Of course, I disagree with his opinion of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. I also took issue with what Armey said when he criticized President Obama as unreasonable and lauded President Clinton as being someone with whom you could work and a reasonable man. Now, that Armey or any Republican member of Congress from the 1990s feels that way would certainly be news to President Clinton and to those of us who remember how Republicans actually treated Clinton during his presidency. I mean, it's bizarre revisionist history. For instance, if they thought Clinton was so good and so reasonable, impeaching him was a pretty odd way of showing it, don't you all think? Of course, those of us who are reasonable know the truth about that kind of stuff. Republicans like to manufacture reasons to be upset at Democratic presidents. Generally, there are no real reasons to be upset, so they got to make stuff up. The Affordable Care Act is basically a conservative approach to health care reform. It's similar to Republican Mitt Romney's approach when he was governor of Massachusetts. But again, Republicans manufactured all of these crazy talking points against it. Socialized medicine, government takeover. No, it's not. People have to buy private health insurance, not government health insurance. Compare that to the reasons that we Democrats were upset at George W. Bush. Crashed the economy, went to war on a lie, didn't pay for either of his two wars to the tune of trillions in debt for poorly run wars, again, one of which was unnecessary and based on a lie. His administration engaged in torture. He botched the response to Hurricane Katrina, and I could go on. There's nothing like any of those complaints against Presidents Obama and Clinton, but there's plenty of manufactured nonsense from Republicans nonetheless. Anyway, I'm looking forward to the Hill managing editor Bob Cusack's commentary on the shutdown. We'll get to that right after this. We don't get fooled again. No. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. My next guest is managing editor of The Hill, a newspaper for and about the U.S. Congress, and it has the largest circulation of any Capitol Hill publication. He's won 5 awards from the National Press Club and also from the Society of Professional Journalists for investigative articles on a wide range of issues, including national security, health care, and the 2008 presidential politics surrounding Hurricane Katrina. He regularly appears on MSNBC, Fox, ABC, and CNN as a political analyst. Before joining The Hill, he was chief editor at Inside Washington Publishers. Mr. Bob Cusack, welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve.
My pleasure. Bob, here we are, nearly a week into the shutdown. No end in sight, really. Before we get into where we are, I want to get into how we got to this crazy place. I mean, it really didn't seem like this was going to happen until 2 to 3 weeks ago. It seemed to come out of nowhere. Was this really as unplanned as it seems, and at least unplanned by the majority of folks?
Yeah, because usually this is a little unusual because, this is a government funding fight. Usually, of course, the parties disagree on how much the government should be funded. But Obamacare, because of implementation problems, has become a leading issue in this debate. So the right, the Tea Party, really rallied on this, that this is our last chance to basically stop Obamacare enrollment, obviously, starting October 1, and then we have the full program going into effect on January 1. So they are basically making their stand, and they have pulled the party establishment, whether that's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell or Speaker John Boehner, saying, nope, we're not going to fund Obamacare, or we're going to delay it, depending on what bill the Republicans have passed. So that's why it's been so difficult to strike a deal, because when you're dealing with numbers, and we had this in 2011, there was a possibility of a government shutdown, but they were arguing over $60 billion, and basically they kind of cut it in half, and then they got a deal. But here it's ideology, and that's why I think this government shutdown could last a little while.
Now, you know many of the players in Congress as well as anyone. What's your impression of the relative state of mind of congressional Democrats and congressional Republicans with regard to the shutdown so far? Does either group feel like they have the upper hand? Does either group feel unhappy about the situation? Does anybody seem ready to capitulate at this point?
Well, I mean, privately, Democrats are, they're very happy. I mean, they're very happy with the shutdown, because before the shutdown, there was probably no chance that Democrats were going to win back the House. Now, that's at least a possibility. I think it's still a remote possibility, but Democrats politically, a lot of them, thought that, well, listen, this will help us in the 2014 midterms. Republicans are very divided. You have centrist Republicans like Peter King. They really want to end the shutdown right now, but they don't really have the votes to compel John Boehner to do that. A lot of people are asking, what is the exit strategy for Speaker Boehner now that he has adopted the Ted Cruz strategy? Overall, I think the Republicans have had a losing hand. They've actually played it pretty well. They've gotten the Democrats to move off of their no-negotiation stance. We've seen in recent days Harry Reid offer some type of compromise. It was rejected by Republicans. We also saw President Obama have a meeting at the White House, which I actually thought was going to happen a little while back, but happened more recently. So I think Democrats are getting a little uncomfortable with their no-negotiation stance and Republicans labeling them as the party of no. But at the same time, the polls do favor the Democrats on this shutdown. So I think this is going to blend into the debt limit fight. So I don't think the shutdown is going to end anytime soon.
I think you're probably right on that. Now, you touched on a couple of things I want to drill down on a little bit more. So you say, as I think most of the polls would agree with, that Republicans right now are getting a higher percentage of the blame than Democrats and the president. But does that affect all Republicans? I mean, obviously, there are Republicans in red states that probably won't be affected by this at all. But you mentioned Peter King and some of the more centrist Republicans. Are those the ones really vulnerable in all of this?
Yes. I mean, I think that when you have – with the gerrymandered House and you have redistricting after the last census, is that there aren't a lot of competitive races overall. And a lot of Republicans in the House, as well as Democrats actually, they worry more about a primary challenge than an actual general election challenge. So let's say if Democrats or a liberal Democrat is going against Obama, well, then maybe he or she has to worry about a primary challenge from the left. Similarly, Tea Party lawmakers or Tea Party candidates will jump into a race if the Republican is viewed as a so-called rhino Republican in name only. So there aren't that many. There are 435 seats in the House. How many close races are we looking at in the midterm elections? I mean, you're probably looking at 60, maybe fewer. But this unrest, this fiscal showdown that has led to a government shutdown, possibly default, maybe that number gets a little bigger, but not much.
Just to let you know, I had Dick Armey on my show earlier, and he said that the key to ending the shutdown was John Boehner. He said that Boehner needs to show leadership and put a clean continuing resolution bill up for a vote. And for the benefit of the audience, some of them who may not know what that means, clean meaning no provisions to defund or delay Obamacare. He said that Boehner really wants this whole mess to go away, but he's afraid of a revolt in his caucus. Do you think that's true, and do you think that he might face a revolt if he puts that bill forward?
Oh, absolutely, and I think it's very noteworthy that Armey told you that. Boehner, without a doubt, is being pushed by the Tea Party and the right. I mean, remember, it was just about a week ago or so that Boehner wanted to go a different strategy than the Ted Cruz strategy. He did not want to – I mean, he's always said he doesn't want to shut the government down, but he didn't want to go over that cliff and jump with the Tea Party. So there is no doubt about it that if he brings a clean government funding bill to the floor, there's going to be a lot of noise from the right. And, you know, there will be some that will question whether he can keep his job. And that's – well, that's what everybody in Washington is talking about right now. Can John Boehner keep his job? There's a lot of speculation that this is going to be the last Congress for John Boehner because he's had it. He's had it with President Obama. Their relationship is very strained, and he's had it with the Tea Party. But, of course, you know, Boehner's aides say, no, he's not going anywhere, but we'll see about that.
Well, and he's got, Eric Cantor waiting in the wings. Eric Cantor, we can't forget, Armey reminded me of this, as a matter of fact, that Cantor basically turned on the gentleman who named him the deputy whip and then challenged him the very next Congress to be the minority whip. And, so he's certainly somebody who is willing to be an opportunist and grab the speakership if that becomes a possibility for him. But on the other side of things, I want to turn to the Democrats for a second. Do you see any signal at all? I think you mentioned Harry Reid earlier, but that congressional Democrats would be willing to go for even like a face-saving compromise for Republicans, something like the repeal of the medical device tax. In other words, something that doesn't really affect Obamacare, but something the Republicans can use to say to the Tea Party wing of their party, look, see, we got something.
You know, I don't think so. I think that Democrats might be willing to give up something, but it has to have nothing to do with Obamacare. The medical device tax was included in Obamacare that was passed in 2010. So I think Democrats, and that's a bipartisan bill, Steve. I mean, you know, you look at the medical device tax, there's 263 co-sponsors in the House. 38 of them are Democrats. So this is
right.
This has the support of liberal Democrats, too, including Al Franken, Elizabeth Warren. But because of the high stakes, I don't see them going along for something like the medical device tax. I think it's got to be something, maybe in some type of entitlement reform, because it's going to get wrapped up in the debt limit debate, whether that's Social Security, CPI, changing that, or Medicare means testing. I just don't think I don't think the Democrats are going to go for anything that changes Obamacare because they've drawn that line in the sand. But at the same time, John Boehner, until he absolutely has to, he is not going to go along with a clean government funding bill unless he gets something so that he can save face. I just think the medical device tax, somewhat of an obscure issue, and I don't think that's going to appease the Tea Party. I don't think a lot of the Tea Party knows what that tax is. They don't really care that much about it. They want to see something bigger. And the Democrats also have said, Harry Reid says that's a stupid idea to repeal that tax as part of this debate anyway.
Okay, you brought up Boehner again. Is it just a time thing? Is he just waiting for a certain amount of time to say, see, we fought the good fight, we did what we could, we couldn't get there, we're putting now a clean bill forward? Or is there a numbers game that Boehner might be playing? So far, I think you had a great article the other day when you mentioned around 8 fellow Republicans that are ready for a clean bill. Several other centrist Republicans might be coming around. Is there a numbers of Republican defectors, so to speak, that Boehner might be looking towards before he puts the clean bill forward?
I've talked to a lot of Republicans in the House, and basically they've said Boehner has told them he has a plan. Okay, And they don't believe, like an exit strategy, they don't quite believe it, and these are among the defectors, the possible defectors that could take a bill down on the House floor, which would be so devastating to John Boehner. You know, you've seen a number of piecemeal bills that have hit the House floor. They've passed, but at the same time, there's always been the threat on a couple of them that the centrists like Peter King and Frank Wolf, Republican from Virginia, who has a lot of government employees in his district and contractors, that they could take the bill down by defecting. And you only need 16 or 17 Republicans to join with Democrats to do that. They haven't done it yet, but they're getting really impatient, especially the vulnerable Republicans in tough races next year. So that's what Boehner's really – he has to worry about that. The centrists are upset at the Tea Party, but do I see that they're going to band together, 20 of them, and take down a bill so that they can force John Boehner's hand? I don't think we're there yet, but maybe in the next several days they could do that. We'll see, but I just don't think we're there yet.
Wow. I have to at this point go back to the fact that this just seems like such a mess, such an ill-conceived plan by a small group of Republicans. We've been hearing about closed-door meetings where Republicans are yelling at Senator Cruz, complaining about this amateurish, I guess you could call it, play to try to get some sort of concession on Obamacare. From your vantage point, does it really seem as badly planned as that?
I think this is the biggest political risk of Boehner's career, without a doubt. When they talk about Boehner's speakership, they're going to be talking about this debate and how he gets out of this, if he gets out of this, remains to be seen. But I think the fact that Boehner could not convince his Republican colleagues to go along with a different strategy other than the Ted Cruz strategy, I mean, I think that really could be the defining moment of his speakership, and that would not be a good thing because he has been embarrassed in the past. The fiscal cliff debate in January, very embarrassing, where he could not convince his guys to go along with his strategy and basically lost all leverage, and President Obama got a lot of what he wanted. So, you know, we've seen that before in prior debates. The farm bill is something the House tried to pass and they couldn't pass it, and they kind of changed their strategy based upon, really, we're talking about 30 Republicans or so, maybe 40 Republicans in the House that like John Boehner personally, but they don't agree with him and don't agree with his strategy. So I do think that there's a when history looks back at this moment, Boehner is playing a very, very dangerous game. He has been able to get out of certain situations before, but I'm not sure he's going to get out of this one.
Okay. Well, I don't know. You know, I don't want to make excuses for him. I'm a Democrat, in case in case I wasn't clear. I don't want to make excuses for Boehner, but it does not seem like it would be easy to try to be reasonable and deal with that Tea Party wing of his party. But what about folks like Senator Cruz, like Senator Lee, the other instigators behind what's happening here? Going in, they seem to be in strong positions. They seem to be strong enough to overcome certainly Speaker Boehner. Is there any chance this might backfire on them?
You know, it could, but I don't think so. I mean, I do think that overall, if Ted Cruz runs for president in 2016, which it looks like he's going to, I think...
And he's leading the polls right now, right?
And he's leading the polls. And this is very popular with the Republican base. I mean, what he's doing, I don't think is popular with independents, but with the base of the Republican Party. And if you look at the first caucus in 2016 for both parties is Iowa. And that's really hardcore Republicans. You've got to Rick Santorum, obviously, you know, it was a close race, but he ended up winning that. So I think this helps him, because right now, without a doubt, I think you'd have to call Ted Cruz the favorite in 2016 Iowa caucus, and I think that helps him as far as what he's trying to do. Remember, he's a freshman senator. He doesn't really have to worry about governing. John Boehner does. Mitch McConnell, they both do. But Ted Cruz has a different agenda, and he has amassed an enormous amount of power. I mean, I've been in Washington since 1995. I have never seen a freshman senator really get this much power in such a short amount of time. He is discussing strategy with House conservatives. So not only is he really leading the Senate Republicans in some respects. He's leading the House Republicans as well. He's leading the party. He's convinced the party to go along with the strategy, or maybe force them into the strategy. And that's why a lot of Republicans are thinking, listen, this guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He has no exit strategy, and this is gonna hurt our party for years to come. And that very well could be the case.
I actually love to see the fact that he's leading Republicans for 2016. I think of all the Republicans that are considered in the top tier of those who might be running for president, I think he's probably the easiest to beat. But that's a discussion probably for another day. If you had to guess, how much longer this nonsense would go on before there's a deal? How much longer would you say? Would you say 3 days, five days? What's your best guess?
Well, my prediction, and I did predict that there would be a shutdown. I talked to a House Republican who had seen me on television, and when I predicted that there would be a shutdown, he said he thought I was crazy. So a lot of members didn't think there would be a shutdown. In Washington, there's always a deal at the last second. But because of what we talked about before, that Obamacare was front and center, we're not just talking about numbers, we're talking about ideology here, I thought there wouldn't be a deal. And sure enough, I think that this could go on for a while. I really think that this is going to – both parties now seem content to have – because they can't get one deal on the government funding bill, now they think, okay, let's wrap it up in the debt limit and maybe we can get one big deal on government funding and the debt limit. Democrats weren't initially crazy about that idea. They kind of wanted the debates to be separate. Now they're fine with it. So I think we're going to go into mid-October – the deadline is October 17th for the debt limit. I think we actually could even go beyond that because a lot of Republicans don't believe the Obama administration that the debt limit must be hiked by October 17th. They think it's around that time. So I think we go actually into that weekend, and eventually a deal will be struck in the 18th, 19th, or 20th. But watch the stock market. That's something that both parties – they know that with 401ks and the 2008 financial implosion, a lot of people lost their savings because of the whole TARP and the financial implosion. And it's interesting to see that, like, since that time, there has not been a big financial bill on the House or Senate floor when the markets were open since 2008 when a bailout bill failed and the stock market plunged almost 800 points. So the parties really watch the stock market very, very closely, and that's why I think that, unless the market really plunges, and we've seen it kind of go up and down over the last week, it really hasn't plunged, but the debt limit's very different, and John Boehner knows that. And I think that John Boehner, I really think that he's going to strike a deal right around mid-October. But as far as the government shutting down, opening up, no, I don't think that happens anytime soon.
Okay. I'm going to go on record here and say that there's a deal struck on Monday, October 14th, but I think you very well could be right. And I think the stock market, it's the thing about the market, as you know, it's not always something that it can be predicted with your mind. It can be a very emotional thing if people feel like their money is at risk. If people feel like a shutdown and a debt ceiling not being overcome is going to really tank the economy, we could see something happen very quickly. And obviously nobody wants to see that.
I agree with you because then we're talking about. The shutdown certainly has economic impact. There's no doubt about it, especially in the Washington area and beyond. But when you're talking about the debt limit, you're talking about the global economy. And so if the market gets jittery, your prediction could very well be right, that by the 14th they have some type of deal that both opens the government and increases the debt ceiling. But the debt limit is far more serious than a shutdown, and they're both very serious, obviously.
I agree. So I'm going to ask you to play prognosticator one more time. Fast forward to 2014. In 2014, does the shutdown help or hurt Republicans, or does it have no effect?
Oh, I think it hurts Republicans. I think that, and we've talked to some Senate Republicans who feel like right now, if you look at all the factors, that, maybe Republicans could win back the Senate because Democrats have to defend a lot more seats than Republicans. And, history is not kind to second-term presidents in the midterm. But right now, they feel like their chances of a majority are slipping away because of what John Boehner and Ted Cruz are doing. So I think the chances of Republicans winning back control of the Senate are diminishing as we speak. Do I think this helps Democrats in the House? Yes. Do I think it's enough for them to win back the House? No, because of gerrymandering. I don't think that they're going to win back the House. But before the shutdown, I thought Republicans would pick up seats in the House. Now I'm not so sure. They probably it probably will be, I think, even, or you know, there won't be much change. But you know, all bets are off when this kind of stuff happens, especially when you're dealing with a debt limit. If we go into default, I mean, then definitely all bets are off.
Okay, I think I agree with you, but we'll have to end it there. Bob Cusack, it was great having you on. He's an award-winning journalist and managing editor of The Hill. Thank you very much for spending time with us today, sir.
Thank you.
Our Hall of Fame and Shame will be up right after this.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night.
And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. We have a tie in our Hall of Fame honors this week. The tie is between Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Miley Cyrus and the cast of Saturday Night Live.
Red states and sweaty bodies everywhere. Bills in the house like we don't care. Cause we came to shut it all down now.
Hey.
No
hey.
Government
hey.
Around
hey.
Now.
Miley Cyrus and the cast of Saturday Night Live share the honors this week for a video they aired Saturday night that was the satirical parody of the Republican government shutdown titled We Did Stop. The skit features a promiscuously behaving Taryn Killam as John Boehner and Cyrus as an equally sexed up Representative Michelle Bachmann. At one point, a horrified President Obama looks in from the outside through a sliding glass door. The fictional Boehner and Bachmann are seen desecrating a flag, attacking Uncle Sam, telling an astronaut and a park ranger no to them working, and generally twerking around and on various politically and government-related people and objects. What's funny and sad at the same time is that there was probably more thought put into this parody video than was put into the strategy of the shutdown by Republicans, which is part of the point of the video. The video drives home the point of how dumb the shutdown is as a political tactic. If you want to see the video, it's on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Sharing the honors with Saturday Night Live and Miley Cyrus is Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. A lot of Democratic congressmen and senators have given good speeches denouncing the shutdown, but Senator Warren stands out as both calling out those responsible in the most stridently accurate language and a call for the adults in the room to take the car wheel back from the irresponsible toddlers in the GOP. Let's listen.
These threats may continue, but they are not working, and they will never work. Because this is democracy. And in a democracy, hostage tactics are the last resort for those who can't win their fights through elections, can't win their fights in Congress, can't win their fights for the presidency, and can't win their fights in the courts. For this right-wing minority, hostage-taking is all they have left, a last gasp of those who cannot cope with the realities of our democracy. The time has come for those legislators who cannot cope with the reality of our democracy to get out of the way so that those of us in both parties who understand that the American people sent us here to work for them can get back to work solving real problems faced by the American people.
Congratulations to Senator Elizabeth Warren and Miley Cyrus and the cast of Saturday Night Live, an interesting contrast between mirthful satire and the most mature and serious of speechmaking, both aimed at the Republican shutdown. Congratulations to both of them for winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. But now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Representative Michelle Bachmann. As if this shutdown wasn't enough of the full spectrum of the bizarre already, Michelle Bachmann has decided to weigh in on it a number of times. This is probably why she caught Saturday Night Live's attention and why she played so prominently in their satire video. Two of her statements caught my attention as well. First, she was on Hannity a few nights ago, and she opined regarding the shutdown, saying this.
Well, we have held together for a long time in this process. I think we will continue to hold on. Ultimately, the Republicans are the conservatives that are going to work together to make sure that we can push back Obamacare. We're really very energized today. We're very strong. This is about the happiest I've seen members in a long time.
So Republicans have put thousands of government workers on furlough. They're not getting paid, these workers. Many government services are not available to citizens right now. It's costing the country billions of dollars, and Bachmann says this is making Republicans the happiest they have been in a while. Wow. By the way, a day or two after she said it, she tried to claim to Wolf Blitzer on CNN that she didn't in fact say it, but you heard it as well as I did. Then also this week, in an interview with WorldNet Daily, she opined on the shutdown, saying that, quote, "I think the reason is because President Obama can't wait to get Americans addicted to the crack cocaine of dependency on more government health care." When you're looking for crazy nonsense, Michelle Bachmann never disappoints. The Republican congressman from Minnesota, Michelle Bachmann, is third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Corbett. At this point, I think I'm going to enter into the record Laser's 10th Rule of Politics. And Laser's 10th Rule of Politics says, if you need to apologize for something, apologize. Do it right. Don't say you apologize if you offended people. Don't say something else that makes it worse. Say, I'm sorry, what I said or what I did was wrong, and I offer my apologies. The end. Pennsylvania Republican Governor Tom Corbett didn't do that. Background is that a member of Governor Corbett's legal team compared gay marriage to a marriage between 12-year-olds. Governor Corbett was asked about this during an appearance on CBS Channel 21 News out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in an interview with Sherry Christian. Instead of applying my 10th rule, here is what Governor Corbett said.
Gay marriage, that's a big topic that's going on right now, continues to be in the news. And we already touched upon, there was a controversial remark made by a member of your legal team comparing gay marriage to the union of 12-year-olds, saying both are illegal, which you called inappropriate.
It was an inappropriate analogy. You know, I think a much better analogy would have been brother and sister, don't you?
I don't know.
Well, we
need to. I don't know. I'm gonna leave the comments to you and your team, but.
I love the long silence after Corbett made his analogy. You could hear the wheels turning in Sherry Christian's head, saying, oh my God, he's asking me to comment on that? How do I remain an impartial observer and interviewer when presented with bigotry like that? What do I do now? This is why I'm glad that I'm on the editorial side of the media house. I can say whatever I want to say. I can say, no, I don't think that's appropriate. I'm offended by it, and I think it makes you a bigot. She couldn't say that, of course. Pennsylvania Republican Governor Tom Corbett is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Republican Senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul. It's one thing to do what the Republicans are doing with the shutdown if they really mean it, if they think that there's really a principle involved in which they strongly believe. It'd still be very wrong to go about it this way. But you could have a minute shred of a level of respect if this was about principle. The problem for Republicans is that everything about this shutdown seems like a contrived temper tantrum. This was confirmed when Senators McConnell and Paul had a conversation, not realizing that McConnell was live on a hot mic.
Do you have a second?
I'm all wired up here.
I just did CNN. I just go over and over again. We're willing to compromise. We're willing to negotiate. I don't think they poll tested. We won't negotiate. I think it's awful for them to say that over and over again.
Yeah, I do too. And I just came back from the 2-hour meeting with them, and that was basically the same view privately as it was publicly.
I think if we keep saying we wanted to defund it, we fought for that, but now we're willing to compromise on this. I think they can't. We're gonna. Well, I know we don't want to be here, but we're going to win this, I think.
See, this isn't about principle. This isn't about anything decent. This is about Republicans, as Senator Warren said, holding the government hostage while engaging in desperate deception. Why do they care whether what they or Democrats are doing is poll tested? What does that have to do with anything? The question is whether Republicans mean what they say. And they don't. And now they're caught. They're caught in a ridiculous and contrived mess of their own creation. This conversation between Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell proves it. Senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul win the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, October 13th, and Monday, October 14th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter, at Stephen Laser, on Facebook, at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.